The Parents Show on Mix 92.6. Sponsored by Raiden Solicitors. Award-winning specialist family lawyers. See raidensolicitors.co.uk.
Hello and welcome to The Parents Show on Mix 92.6. Now we have a very special guest on the show tonight. I'm joined by children's poet, or poet generally, Sarah Zyman, who is a local to St. Albans, or to the Hertfordshire area that we're in. And she is a children's poet who you will just thoroughly enjoy talking to or hearing from. So, Sarah, thanks a million for joining us on The Parents Show.
Thanks for having me, Lydia.
So, you're a poet, primarily a children's poet. That's how you prefer to write for children, isn't that right?
I do write for adults as well. I've had the odd poem in some of the Candlestick Press publications that you'll find in bookshops, but also in gift shops. They do those 10 poems about different themed collections. But it's just so much more fun to write for children. It really is. I think I am a big kid, and I just remember lots from my childhood. And, you know, I've got my own children who went to school, and it just brought it all back. And so, yeah, writing with children is just a lot more fun. And children love poetry. They're very open to it, we found.
Well, that's why I was dying to talk to you, because poetry, it's funny. I think the older we get, the less accessible poetry seems to get. I mean, I know from my kind of school days, having exams in Emily Dickinson and Keats and Yeats and this kind of stuff, and really finding it probably put a distance between me and poetry. But is that the case today? How do you feel about the poetry that's been written today?
I think that's very common once you're studying it if you're sort of forced to study it at GCSE, and you're thinking, well, who are these dead poets? What's their relevance to my life? I don't understand. And having to really study it at a line level sucks all the joy out of it. But there's actually been a big boom in contemporary children's poets. There's lots of anthologies being published again. The children's poetry community is really welcoming and supportive. And we're finding that primary school children absolutely love poetry. It's very accessible. I mean, it's not like in the days of A.A. Milne, where you've got Christopher Robin going off to London with his nurse. I remember seeing that. It seemed impossibly ancient when I was young. Lovely poems, but maybe not very relevant to children of today. Why has he got a nurse? Is he sick? What does this mean? You know, we've got rap poets like Carl Nova, brilliant performance poets like Neil Zetter and Joshua Siegel. There's Coral Rumble, Carol Bromley. So many people writing for children now, doing school visits, getting into anthologies. And kids love poetry. It can be funny. It can tell them something in just a page. It's also really good for reluctant readers, because there's none of that. You know, a poem can often be on one page. There's a lot of welcoming white space. There's not a forest of pages after it. You can open a poetry book on any page, read one poem in 2 minutes, and you've achieved something. It's not like you've got a whole book to go, all these chapters that need to be read in order. You can open my book and read it from wherever you like.
That's a brilliant. I'd never thought about poetry being a good gateway for reluctant readers. Of course, you're right. And you can open up any page and you've jumped into a different world.
And you've achieved something. You've finished something. You've read it from the start to the end. If you'd like to read another one, you can. But there's nothing saying, oh, you're not finished yet. You're not done. There's a forest of pages ahead. You know, it's fine.
Lovely. And Sarah, have you always loved poetry? I mean, is this something that you've kind of pursued all your life? Or what role has poetry played in your life up to now?
I have loved it for a long time. I think I probably first discovered it. Well, my dad wrote poetry and has had some collections for adults, and he used to sort of make up little rhymes for me and my sister. But I think probably my earliest introduction to poetry that I understood and that spoke to me as a child would have been Please, Mrs. Butler by Allan Ahlberg. I bet a lot of your listeners, even if they think they didn't like poetry, I bet they remember the poem Please, Mrs. Butler and the other school poems in there. I was probably about 8. And I just recognized all the scenarios that he was talking about. I went to a Welsh Valleys primary school, and there weren't any children called Derek, actually. That was one of the few things. Some of the names felt a little bit old-fashioned, but you know, there was the excitement of the doll getting into the playground, or that horrible feeling when you've quarreled with your best friend and they've gone off with someone else. You know, or the knit nurse coming in and you're standing there in the corridor going, I hope I don't have knit. And of course, the title poem, Please, Mrs. Butler, is all about a telltale. And I think we all remember that. Please, miss, that boy is, you know, and that really spoke to me. And I think it stayed with me. And I did write some poems when I was young. I had one in a Cadbury's book of children's poetry that they used to put out. And then when I was about 13, one of my poems appeared on, I don't know if you remember, it's been running for many years, the Poetry on the Underground.
Of course. So
by, you know, very famous poets as well as contemporary poets, made into posters and put on the tube carriages. And one of my poems was up there when I was, 13 or so. I never actually saw it going around because we lived in South Wales, but I'm assured that it did go around on the tube for a little while then.
That's fantastic. I mean, it's so amazing to see your journey. So, you know, when you enter those, you know, you see those competitions and you're thinking, is there any point in applying? There absolutely is. It's part of your journey, isn't it? That, I mean, yeah, I absolutely remember the Poetry in the Underground. I remember thinking, wow, they must be like amazingly talented people to get their poetry up in the London Underground. You know, it's great.
I think at the time I didn't really realise the significance of it. And I think when you're younger, you try to write in a very grown-up fashion. And I think as I've got older, I probably regressed somewhat, actually.
Or you found your true voice.
Break then from writing poetry, really, for 20-odd years, probably, until I had my children and they went to school. And then they'd come home and tell me about funny things that had happened. Like, oh, yes, I remember that kind of thing happening. And then I started to write some poems. They found them amusing. I started sending them off to children's magazines, entered some competitions, and it just sort of went from there, really.
Fantastic. Well, I'm so glad you found your way back to poetry. I think a lot of us mums and dads out there, having children does kind of reset you a little bit and can often bring you back on a path that you were meant to, or it makes you tune in to the things that you were always interested in. But it's
I think you're right, you know, whether it's your child getting into dance, or you know, wanting to ride ponies, and you wanted to do that when you were little, and you sort of go with their hobbies and discover new things about yourself.
Yeah. So tell us, so how is your Yeah, I've been looking at your website, and it's sarahziman.co.uk, Z-I-M-A-N. I love it. I mean, there's so much energy in your website, and it really kind of makes me want to hear your poems. Can you tell us how do you go about writing your poems, and like what environment you create for yourself in order to be inspired, or how do you do it?
Well, I mean, for a long time, I did sort of wait for the muse to appear, but that's not always the most effective way of writing a collection, because you could be, you know, several weeks or months. Sometimes you do just have to sit down and get on with it. But there are a lot of websites that will give you prompts. There's a very active children's poetry community on, well, what was once Twitter and is now called X. And we'll give each other ideas. I'm a member of an online poetry stanza, as they call them, and we're children's poets for the zigzag stanza. And we'll sort of set homework and discuss poems together. And so I do have some first readers there as well. Actually, my children are my first readers, and then my poetry group are the second. And they've been really, really helpful. So yeah, I think it's something you just have to sit down and get on with it.
Yeah, that makes sense.
The funny things that the children have said, or a joke, or a realization that a word can have two meanings, and think, oh, I wonder if I could work that into a poem.
lovely curiosity about it. I mean, and you've had amazing reviews, like Conrad Burdekin, who is a children's poet, said he gets a feeling of Shel Silverstein mixed with Dahl, mixed with Hilaire Belloc. I mean, you've got some amazing reviews for your poetry. I'm trying to get our listeners ready for a little bit of a demo. So would you mind reading some of your poems for us, your favourite ones? Because we'd love to hear it straight from you.
Okay, let's start off with, I call this one of these, what, there's a lot of school poems in Why Did My Brain Make Me Say It?
So actually, let's take a step back. Tell us about Why Did My Brain Make Me Say It?
Oh, Why Did My Brain Make Me Say It? Well, the title comes from a poem called Faux Pas, which is about that most mortifying of school experiences, or it was to me, and I've been told by the children in primary school this is still an embarrassing thing for some reason. You know, when you accidentally, you're in class, you're comfortable, and you want to get your teacher's attention, and you accidentally call them mum, and it's the mortifying, no, I meant to say Mrs. McAllister, but I called them mum, oh no, and everyone's laughing, and it's terribly embarrassing. I mean, I remember that from when it's about, I don't know, nine, maybe. Actually, when I went into secondary school, my dad was my teacher.
Oh my gosh.
It was okay to call him dad because he was my dad. Although I avoided calling him anything, to be honest.
Yeah, well, that's probably a good strategy. But yeah, I think if people haven't done it, they've had a nightmare around doing that, haven't they?
Yeah. So that's where the title came from. But it's not a purely school-based collection. I mean, it's loosely based around a school year. But I wanted to include poems that play with words or just the idea of poetry itself as poems about family. See, poems that acknowledge things like divorce or the loss of a grandparent or like a really well-loved pet, those kind of sad things that lots of children will go through. You know, poems about nature. And then there are some poems that are responses to those what-if questions. So that's quite a good way of sitting down to write a poem. Say, what if Medusa came into the hairdressers? What happened? You know, what if Superman was really badly behaved when he was at school? That kind of thing. So I like writing the answers to those kind of questions. Okay, so I'm going to read to you a poem called Dear Mrs. Kent. And I think you might get an idea as to who Mrs. Kent is, the mum of. She's receiving a letter home from school from a rather cross school teacher. Dear Mrs. Kent, I fear I must write home to say the way that Clark behaved today fell rather short in most respects of standards that this school expects. It pains me to call Clark a cheat, but when he reads my answer sheet with X-ray vision, I'm perplexed. Are we quite sure he needs those specs? And levitating in the hall? It's not acceptable at all. He said, you told us not to run, and flying really is more fun. But using freeze breath on my tea, well, that was the last straw for me. It turned to ice and cracked my cup, and frankly now, I'm quite fed up. Don't get me wrong. His future's bright if he could just learn wrong from right. Might I suggest a sticker chart? Yours sincerely, Mrs. Hart. P.S. A note on uniform. Now that the days are getting warm, the shorts are fine, but could he stop the wearing underpants on top?
That's lovely. It's such a lovely poem. And that falls into the what-if category.
Yes, you might have guessed that maybe Superman wasn't always, or Clark Kent, as he was at school, you know, maybe wasn't always the best behaved. Naughty, naughty boy.
Lovely, lovely. And can you give us a flavour of another type of a poem that you like and have written?
Of course. Okay. Here's one for probably a lot of children. As we're in September now, a lot of children will have just gone up to their new secondary schools and they'll have, you know, finished year six, had that whole summer break, and just not being quite sure what's going to happen next and who they are. So it's a poem called Inbetweener. Well, here is a puzzle I can't seem to fix. Am I in year 7? Or still a year 6? Primary is over. It's finished, all done. There's no doubt about it. The summer's begun. I've taken my books home. I've emptied my tray. No need to rehearse for the end of school play. My hooks are all empty. My polo shirt signed. I've sat all my sats. Left my first school behind. See, secondary's coming. A total clean slate. But that's in September, all summer to wait. I need a new backpack. I'll wear a new tie. The teachers don't know me. And neither do I. Just who will I be when I enter this school? A minuscule fish in a gigantic pool. Yes, I am a puzzle I can't seem to fix. Not quite in year 7. No longer year 6. And I just remember my own children sort of saying they finished and going, so what year am I in? I don't know.
Oh, that's...
Where is your year 7? But I haven't started yet.
That is so, it hits, actually, I got a bit goosebumpy when you were talking about, you know, my hooks are empty and your t-shirt signed and everything. Is really, you've really captured a very special moment for everyone. Everybody goes through that, that transition.
Thank you.
Really beautifully captured. Have you got more delights for us?
I do. Hopefully delightful. This one's called Secret Weapon. And it is from the point of view of a child. I quite often write from their point of view. Secret Weapon. I always have some blue tack in my pocket. When I get distracted, it helps to squash it. Mum got cross when I forgot it and it went through the wash. But what she doesn't realise is that it's my secret weapon. Just a little piece on the nose and a normal paper aeroplane is a stunt plane. Has your tooth come out just before school photos? Tiny bit and ta-da! Miss says that wasn't my finest hour. She wasn't very happy when I was flicking it at Freddy either. That time it was alien bogeys. But when I fixed her wobbly chair at parents' evening, she was quite impressed. It's my secret weapon for sports day too. But don't tell anyone. I've been the undisputed egg and spoon champ ever since year 3. Once, I made it into 2 rings, and me and Ella May wore them all through lunch. But afterwards, she turned hers into a dolphin, so I turned mine into a troll. Miss says that if I ever finish this poem, perhaps we can use some to put it on the wall.
That is just, it's just beautiful. And I could imagine having this anthology, your book, Why Did My Brain Make Me Say It, kind of on the kitchen table or, you know, beside a bed and just have a little flick through to make you smile, make a child smile or just read it before bed. Is that what you had in mind or how did
That's
you imagine?
That's something I would absolutely love. Yeah. I mean, poetry is for any time of day. I would love to see it in libraries. I'd love to see it in classrooms at school where children can borrow it, whether it's in their class book corner or the actual library. A lot of them are there to perform or just, you know, just to make you think. But yeah, definitely. I mean, I would love to have it in the in the bedroom of every child in the land. That would be great.
Yeah. Can we ask you for another poem, please, Sarah?
Okay. Well, this is something that I always hated and my children also have very strong opinions on school shoes, but unfortunately schools also have strong opinions on school shoes, don't they? So they have to be they have to be sensible and they have to be black and they tend to be clumpy and they tend to be this. So this one is called New School Shoes.
Great, thank you.
Box fresh, but they're total nasties. Kind of look like Cornish pasties. Why can't Mum see these are ghastly new school shoes? No, they'll turn my toes to mincemeat. Rather wear boots made of concrete, like 2 cruise ships steering my feet. New school shoes. Made to walk around the shop floor, clomping like an angry centaur. These kicks are a total eyesore. New school shoes. Street cred killed dead as the dodo, shunned like poor old Quasimodo, boring and safe as a Volvo. New school shoes. no way I'll be winning races, tripping over two long laces. Well, of course I'm pulling faces. New school shoes. I think we've all been there, either as a parent or a child, and it's painful for everyone.
It is safe as a Volvo. I like that. I like that a lot. Brilliant. You really hit the nail on the head. Yeah, and to be honest with you, that's just not just a primary school problem. It's the same when you get into secondary, isn't it?
Possibly worse.
Yeah, particularly if you've got tall children. Great. So, Sarah, have you got one or two up your sleeve before we wrap up for today?
Let's have packed lunch. This is one from quite a while ago, but it's always popular. On Monday, I opened my lunchbox and I had a ham sandwich, some cheese and onion crisps, and an apple. On Tuesday, I opened my lunchbox and I had a cheese sandwich, some ham and onion crisps, and an apple. On Wednesday, I opened my lunchbox and I had a ham and cheese sandwich, some apple crisps, and an onion. On Thursday, I opened my lunchbox and I had a sandy ham, some crispy onion, and a cheesy witch. On Friday, I had school dinners.
So much of what you're saying is relatable. So I really get what you're saying about you write for poetry, but actually this resonates with parents too, with grown-ups too.
That was just a sort of silly mess around with the words there as well. It's just kind of playing about with how things could get mixed up. By the time it was Thursday, it doesn't sound very appetizing. Sandy ham. And I don't know what a cheesy witch is, but it's not something that you really want in your lunchbox.
No, absolutely. But and I love the thing, it's like Friday, school lunch. Because you do run out of steam by the end of the week, don't you?
Yeah.
So, Sarah, when is Why Did My Brain Make Me Say It? When is it out?
So, with any luck, it should be available in the week of National Poetry Day. So we've got National Poetry Day coming up on October the 3rd. And Why Did My Brain Make Me Say It should be available on October the 4th from anywhere that you would usually buy your books. So online at all the usual book emporiums and in local bookshops. And if they don't have it, they can order it for you. But yeah, you should be able to find it on Amazon, Waterstones, all the usual websites.
From October 4th.
Yeah.
Fantastic. So Why Did My Brain Make Me Say It? Sarah Zimon. And Sarah, can we squeeze out one more of your poems before we let you go?
Okay, let's have, this is a silly one. I think anyone who's had a younger sibling, doesn't have to be a little sister, just a younger sibling in general, might recognize this one. It's called Reasons My Little Sister Cried This Week. Biscuit broke, could not be mended, asked to brush her teeth, offended. Wanted blue cup, not the pink. Given blue cup, kicked up stink. Refused to walk, lay down on path. Stopped from drinking bubble bath. Not allowed to pull cat's tail. Not allowed to lick a snail. Not allowed to throw mum's phone. Granny told her that she'd grown. Unable to push down tree. From a distance, saw a bee. Dropped her ice cream. Big disaster. Cross that I can run much faster. Left at preschool, howled in vain. Picked up later, same again. Did not want help to do up shoes. Found banana had a bruise. Dolly's socks would not go on. Duck ate bread she'd meant for swan. Jigsaw puzzle proved quite tricky. Toast and honey was too sticky. Kicked the ball at goal and missed. Not happy that I wrote this list.
Wonderful. Thank you. Thank you so much, Sarah. So you very kindly on your website not just mentioned your book, but actually given a lovely signposting to other authors, other poets. Can you tell us a little bit about the other people you've got links to on your website?
Some of those will be anthologists where I've got poems within there. So if you want something for slightly older children, there's a lovely new anthology by Anna Sampson that's just come out. It's called it's all about myths and legends, basically. It's a follow-up to the very successful Gods and Monsters, which came out last year. They're lovely hardback anthologies. And they're also illustrated by Chris Riddell. He's the political cartoonist for The Observer. He's a children's author himself and just a fantastic illustrator. So it's all fully illustrated, really lovely gift book. I should give a shout out to Brian Moses as well, who is a wonderful, very famous, very, very anthologized poet for children. He was the first person to put one of my poems in a book, which was amazing. So he's got a poem called The Best Ever Book of Funny Poems. I'm in that, which is lovely. There's a book by Matt Goodfellow, Poems for 8-year-olds. So yeah, I mean, there's all sorts of stuff out there, whether you want funny poems, thoughtful poems, nature poems. You know, I really recommend that there will be something for you and your child out there. Even if they think they don't like poetry, they do. There will be a poem out there and a poet for you.
Brilliant. Perfect stocking fillers. That's what I'm thinking as I'm flicking through the books there. And what a lovely gift to share the kind of the beauty of poetry. It's really fantastic. Sarah, any last tips for parents who are listening in about enjoying poetry with your children? I think we're all a tiny bit scarred by the Emily Dickinson. I mean, she's an incredibly talented poet and I keep picking on her, which is really bad. But I think we're kind of maybe a bit alienated from poetry, and hearing you today has made me feel much closer to poetry. But what would you say to parents who are out there listening who are in a similar situation to me, where you think, oh, I can't do poetry? How would you break down barriers for them?
I think it's really nice at the end of the day, if you're reading to your child in bed, you know, as well as my children used to insist on lots of songs before bed, as well as a story, but we would also do a poem. So they can pick one, you can pick one. You know, a lot of them are funny. A lot of them are about life today. There's nonsense poems, you know. They don't have to be difficult. They don't have to be impenetrable, Victorian. There's a lot of anthologies out there for children. Choose one and, you know, just open it at random. See what comes up, see what speaks to you. Not every poem is going to talk to you, but there will be something out there where you just get, ah, yes, that's happened to me, or I've felt like that. I've been in that situation. Actually, can I just give you one more? There's a good one for bedtime.
Please.
It's called Sleep Pattern. So this one has two different ways to read it. So if you read it from top to bottom, it says one thing. But then if you read it bottom to top, it says something else. So here's Sleep Pattern read the traditional way. I have to go to bed. Please don't insist that it's far too early. My eyes aren't heavy. The sky is not even dark. I'm yawning. It's ridiculous to tell me read just one more chapter, sing another song, run about outside, finish watching TV. It's never been more important to look at what time it is. After all, why am I in my pyjamas? But if you then get your child to read it from bottom to top, you get quite a different story. So we start with the last line and read it upwards. Why am I in my pyjamas? After all, look at what time it is. It's never been more important to finish watching TV, run about outside, sing another song, read just one more chapter. It's ridiculous to tell me I'm yawning. The sky is not even dark. My eyes aren't heavy. It's far too early. Please don't insist that I have to go to bed.
I love that. I can see that being a bit of a tug of war at bedtime between kids and parents.
Which way are we going to read?
Yes. Exactly.
Is it bedtime or not?
Exactly. Oh, that's excellent. And I love that you touch on sensitive issues. You mentioned this earlier that, you know, you touch on, you know, friends leaving you behind or divorce or things like that. Why do you think it's important to kind of to blend those sensitive topics into your work?
I think because it's never been more difficult, I think, to be a child. There's a lot of pressure. There are a lot of worries. You know, families are going through a lot of things, and it's never been more important for children to see themselves in books. That's extremely important. I mean, I think in recent years, the children's book industry has made strides to try and make sure that books are more inclusive, you know, so that children of colour see themselves, children of different religions, different backgrounds. It's, you know, you can't be what you don't see. So it's really important for every child to see themselves, their family, their situation in children's literature and within poems. And, you know, unfortunately, the reality of life is that some children will be in blended families. You know, their parents will have separated. They might be living with a grandparent or the single parent. You know, you have a family pet. And unfortunately, part of having a pet is that they don't live as long as we do. These things do happen. They affect children. And I think it's really important for children's mental health just to see that they're not alone, that these things, you know, they do happen.
Absolutely. And I couldn't agree more. And certainly when you see it in print and realise that there's absolutely nothing strange or unusual in those different situations, it helps reinforce and reassure, doesn't it?
I hope so.
Sarah, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you today. And thanks so much for sharing your love of poetry, your joy of poetry, the cheekiness of poetry, I think we can say as well. And just to remind everybody, so October 3rd, World Poetry Day, and October 4th, why did my brain make me say it, is out there to be bought on all usual kind of bookshop places, online and in person.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
It's been an absolute pleasure. That was Sarah Simon, who is a local poet and mainly a children's poet from our area in Hertfordshire. And tonight I'm really delighted to be joined by Binnie Fagura, who's an associate solicitor at Raiden Solicitors here in St Albans. Welcome, Binnie. Thanks a million for joining us.
Hello, Lydia. Really good to be here. Thank you.
So you're an associate solicitor at Raiden's. Can you tell us a little bit about your role?
Yes, so I advise on a wide range of family law matters. I assist clients following the breakdown of their relationship, financial matters arising from that breakup, children proceedings, and those that need protection from abuse. I can also assist those unmarried couples following their relationship breakdown. So Raiden Solicitors are a family law specialist, and we can cover all those areas of family law.
Thank you. Now, we love getting your practical advice around divorce, because no matter what, it is still a little bit delicate and a very sensitive subject, even though it is commonplace. If somebody listening in today feels their marriage is effectively over, what would you say to them as the first thing to consider?
And like you're saying, it is a sensitive topic. It's a difficult first step to take. Having that realisation that your marriage is over doesn't just have an impact on the people involved. You think of your children, the wider family and friends who have all been part of your life for many years. My first advice to anybody, be it a telephone call from anyone or on the, you know, out and about, is to always try and speak to a solicitor. It's important to be able to look at your options and consider things going forward as a whole from someone that's independent and without that emotion. That would also put any worries that you might have to rest, so that you've got that clarity and you know what next steps to take. Anybody that's facing divorce may have questions as to what would happen to the family home. Can they stay there? Do they need to leave? Do they have rights to remain there? What will happen to the children if they've separated? How much time are they going to spend with mum or dad? So it's lots of questions like that. And having a meeting with a solicitor can just put your mind at ease, and you'll know what rights you have then going forward.
And I think that's great advice, because no matter what, the rumour mill kicks in and people hear horror stories, and you're better off hearing it from a professional instead of hearing things through Chinese whispers of what really happens when a divorce, because obviously every situation is different. So it makes complete sense.
Absolutely. And you're always, you know, it's like the doctor says, don't Google your symptoms. And it's very similar with divorce. You will go on to Google and you may read horror stories, or you may speak to somebody that perhaps hasn't had a good experience with the process. Every situation and scenario is unique and different. So whatever's happened to a friend won't necessarily apply to you. So it's always very then good to speak to somebody that can give you the options, set out the law and what there is to consider, and also the best way forward for you to protect yourself and be in the best position to progress matters.
Arm yourself with good advice and the law, as you say. Exactly, Binny. Now, I want to ask you, if there's actually a sequence of events or a sequence of actions you need to take, and is there a particular order you should do things in if you do take a decision to separate or divorce?
Yeah, I mean, some parties will realise and have an amicable divorce. That may just be if they both decided that it's no longer going to work and they want to take that step. Once they've decided to do that, they will then go and apply for a divorce, either on a joint application or a sole application. The laws have changed recently, and everyone at the courts recognise that to start this process amicably, let's change the way that divorce works so that there's no blame assigned to either party. So there are still a lot of cases where there are these joint applications in the hope that the process will be amicable going forward. Once a divorce process has started, that's when the discussions will take place regarding finances and children. You'll get a good period of time to discuss that. Divorce doesn't necessarily mean court proceedings. I think people sometimes think, I'm going through a divorce, I'm going to end up in the court system. You know, court proceedings are an absolute last resort, and that's exactly what I'd advise my clients. There are mediation, go parties discussing things amicably. There's nothing stopping parties sitting down together, talking about their finances, providing it's safe to do so and there's no concern, and then speaking to a solicitor and saying, this is what we've agreed. If you have those discussions, then you can speak to your solicitors and say, this is what we've agreed. And at that point, we can get involved and see the agreement that has been reached, whether it's fair, and then we can advise clients in respect of that. If the finances are pretty straightforward and it's all okay, that's when the agreement will be finalised by way of a consent order and submitted to the court. That's very important, because that will then end any future financial claims that the parties have against the other. So it's very important to seek advice at that point so that that's all rubber stamped by the court.
Brilliant. That makes so much sense, Binny. Thank you so much. And I suppose, I mean, I just want to take a step back. You said the first thing to do is to contact a solicitor. And of course, that doesn't mean everything just suddenly goes at a, you know, lightning pace and you're divorced before you know it. You can have a conversation, you can find out your rights and then decide. It doesn't mean it's not at a kind of a step that you can't take back.
Absolutely. And that's the advice that I always give everybody I speak to. Have the meeting. There's no obligation to take things forward. It's just a meeting that you've got. You've then realised, I've got the information that I need. I can then either decide that I want to speak to my spouse directly, or if there, you know, there may be concerns for safety, and having those conversations on your own at home may not be the best advice. So just having that information, being able to hold on to that information, you can then decide how you want to progress matters going forward. But it's just vital having that first meeting, just so that you know, especially where there are children involved, because ultimately you'd want to reduce any conflict, remain amicable for their sake, because they will be witness to it. And if there is that anger between couples, which sometimes there can be, especially if one spouse has ended the relationship and it was, you know, to the surprise of the other, the acrimony can start early on. And, you know, to reduce any conflict, it's really to be as amicable as possible for the sake of the children, who can unfortunately get dragged into everything.
I think everybody's mindful of that, but it happens, doesn't it? Even with the best intentions.
Absolutely.
I wanted to ask you just quickly about the no-fault divorce. Has that kind of taken tension out of divorces for people? How is it working, actually?
Yes, there's lots of research into it, and that's, you know, what they, you know, the intention was for this process to be amicable from the outset. The quickest way traditionally was to assign blame, because parties would end their relationship. There was, you know, 2 years separation, which they didn't want to wait for. So it was going down the unreasonable behaviour route. And where parties weren't necessarily hostile towards one another, when they received this petition, there would be lots of examples of how badly behaved the other spouse was. And from that, the issues would stem very early on. So this way, we've definitely noticed that you can just go straight on to just say, I've applied for a divorce. There's no reason. And the process just follows. So it definitely has made a difference, and that parties then don't feel that I've got to come up with reasons as to why I now don't want to live with my husband or my wife.
Brilliant. That's great to know that it's been a positive step forward. Now, if we're thinking about the most important things to bear in mind about approaching the divorce process from the start, what would you advise?
So where there are children, we'd always say try and not have any conversations in the presence of the children. Their world will ultimately be turned upside down. They will know that mum and dad now not living together. It will impact them or where they will be living. So to try and have those discussions away from the children is always advisable. And it's, you know, there's nothing wrong in speaking to the children's teachers if they're at school, just to make sure that they can keep an eye on them, because they may want to be strong in front of their parents, but at school they may crumble. So it's always good to kind of reach out to them. And also, you know, if couples don't want to go down the route of speaking to solicitors, then they should always try mediation. You know, mediation would be them involved in a room with a mediator who can give them some guidance as to where matters should eventually go. It's a cheaper option. And there's lots of changes in the family procedure rules that the courts are, you know, intent on parties attending mediation and exploring non-court dispute alternatives rather than court. So it's, like I've said previously, court is an absolute last resort, and the court also want to see that as well. They want to see that parties are engaging in other forms of dispute resolution.
That's great to know. I have to say, I'd say it'll be very reassuring to listeners to know that it doesn't automatically end up in court, because no. I think that's another one of the kind of Chinese whispers or rumour mill things where people just think it's going to be end up like a Hollywood drama where, you know, people are shouting at each other in a courtroom.
That's it. And having the cost. And no, it doesn't need to be like that. I mean, there will be circumstances where it's unavoidable and court proceedings will need to be initiated. You know, that could be a situation where, you know, by one spouse has always worked and has control of the finances and the other spouse is at home and has absolutely no idea what's going on. And so, you know, the person that doesn't really have an idea about the finances will need that advice, because he or she won't know what they're entitled to, be it there's lots of assets and trusts or businesses. So in those circumstances, if the other party is not playing ball when we're trying to have sensible discussions, there'll be no alternative but then to put some pressure on with court proceedings. But throughout all the court proceedings, even when they're initiated, at any time parties can reach an agreement and those court proceedings can fall away. So it's good to apply pressure. There is always that fallback.
Brilliant. Thank you. And what are the usual pitfalls we as couples, whether married or not, fall into when it comes to approaching divorce or getting a divorce?
I think importantly, and I'm reiterating seeking advice, but I think some people may think, well, actually, I don't need to speak to a solicitor. We can do this ourselves, which is great. Have those discussions by speaking to others. The difficulty is sometimes you might speak to somebody who doesn't give you good advice. It might be a family member who gives you bad advice or applies their situation to your situation. And if you then reach an agreement and you say haven't finalised a consent order or just something like that, you don't realise. You may think, well, we've done the divorce process. I've got the final point of final divorce. We don't need to worry about our finances. But actually, your financial claims remain open. So without speaking to someone, you won't know. So, you know, there is that aspect to it.
So keep an eye on the finance. Don't think that it's an automatically, you know, automatically resolved in the divorce thing.
Absolutely. The financial claims need to end. And not keeping things amicable, which it's difficult if a party is hurt or the other party has been dishonest. You know, your instant reaction might be anger and revenge, but it's then just to try and keep things as amicable as possible. And kind of another pitfall is just using children really in the proceedings if someone is unhappy because, you know, their financial situations change. They will then say, well, you're not seeing the children. And often that's something that happens. And then it's almost like a downward spiral.
I think that's the one that everybody knows most about, and the one that's kind of a pitfall that's quite easy to slip into.
Absolutely,
particularly
yes.
If you're bitter or hurt, or as you say, if there's been dishonesty involved, you really have to kind of dig deep to be the bigger person.
Sure, I agree. It's hard.
Yeah,
it is hard.
It pays off.
It does pay, yeah, in the long run. If the children feel secure with both their parents, it's better in the long run for them as well.
That makes sense. So, Binny, we'd love your top tips. We're milking you for so much advice. What are your top tips for people who are listening in now who think, you know what, I just don't think there's any way out. I think this is it. What would you say to them?
Process it. It's a difficult process and you need to accept it as well as the person going through it. It has, and it can have a big toll on the person that's going through it. So we would always say, seek support from friends, go to a GP if you're really struggling. If you find that you can have discussions with your partner, then do so. But if at any point you feel that you can't because you're worried about physical, verbal abuse, then don't have them. Have a solicitor that does that for you. Yes, speaking to a solicitor is always my top tip, just so that you can go through your options and then take that away and decide how you want to proceed going forward. And see if you can just agree things as much as you can together. You know, what will happen with the family home? Can one party or one person stay in the home? Can the other one move out for a while until the children finish their education? Is there enough money that the situation could continue for the interim period? Particularly if there's a spouse at home that doesn't have any income and is reliant upon the person that's working, and that person then cuts all income, then the other person will want to seek advice immediately because they need to be able to continue to live. So yes, having that advice is definitely beneficial, and exploring mediation, it's really helpful. And that's another way for everything to stay amicable as possible.
Brilliant. Thank you. Thank you so much for helping us navigate this
subject.
It's been brilliant talking to you, Binny. Thanks a million.
I hope you found that helpful. It was really lovely to be here. Thank you so much.
Thanks for coming.
The Parents Show on Mix 92.6, sponsored by Raiden Solicitors, award-winning specialist family lawyers. See raidensolicitors.co.uk.